The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we will continue with the article we began on last program, titled The Art of the Scam by Jordan Michael Smith. A decades-long forgery scheme ensnared Canada's most famous Indigenous artists, a rock musician turned sleuth, and several top museums. And this article details how the investigators unraveled the biggest art fraud in history. So Norval Morisseau was titled The Picasso of the North. He single-handedly invented the Woodland School of Art, which fused European and Indigenous traditions to create striking, vibrant images featuring thick black lines and colorful interiors of humans, animals, and plants, as though they had been x-rayed and their insides were visible and filled with unusual patterns and shapes. He was one of the first Indigenous painters to garner national attention and first to have a solo exhibition at the National Gallery of Canada in Ottawa. Right before his death in 2001, Canada's National Post newspaper broke the news that Morisseau was accusing an auction house outside of Toronto for selling fakes. Morisseau's opponents, auctioneers, gallery owners, and collectors claimed that he was speaking incorrectly due to his Parkinson's and alcohol abuse had made him forget which ones he had painted. So Canadian law enforcement opened an investigation, but were unable to come to any sort of conclusion in 2008. And it looked like somebody outside of law enforcement would have to force the issue if there was going to be any progress in exposing the fraud. Fortunately, several buyers were angry to learn that they may have been sold fakes, including a Scottish-Canadian singer named John McDermott, who in 2013 sued a gallery that sold him a disputed Morisseau. McDermott says that he had conducted his own investigation into the provenance of the painting, which he had come to believe was fake. Moreover, he claims he could identify the culprits. Among other names, there were two Thunder Bay toughs named Gary Lamont and David Voss, who, he told the courts, produced and resold fraudulent Morisseaus in large numbers, usually large-scale paintings on paper or canvas, like most authentic Morisseau works. According to later comments by Thunder Bay police, Lamont and Voss were veterans of the drug underworld in Thunder Bay, a city of roughly 100,000 that had routinely endured Canada's highest rates of homicide, particularly involving Indigenous peoples. Violent crimes are common amid a struggling economy, a housing crisis, an opioid epidemic, and persistent racial animus among many locals against Indigenous people arriving from reserves across northern Ontario. According to McDermott, the men sold fakes online to collectors, dealers, and auction houses. Indeed, it was Voss who had supplied the auction house outside Toronto with the fakes that aroused Morisseau's attention in 2001. McDermott dropped the claim for unknown reasons, and his representatives did not respond to numerous requests for comment. But other auctioneers, collectors, and buyers began looking to the courts to adjudicate their disputes as well. One of them was a rock star. Kevin Hearn plays keyboards for the band Bare Naked Ladies, best known in the United States for the 1998 mega hit One Week, and for writing the theme song for the sitcom The Big Bang Theory. The band has sold more than 15 million records, and its success has allowed Hearn to get serious about art collecting. He had long appreciated Indigenous art and was moved that Morisseau spoke of using his painting as a way of healing others. In 2005, Hearn purchased a Morisseau painting called Spirit Energy of Mother Earth for $20,000 Canadian from a Toronto gallery that assured him it wasn't one of those frauds Hearn had heard rumors about. In fact, 2 years earlier, Morisseau had sent the gallery a letter informing it that several of its Morisseaus were fake. In 2010, Hearn lent the canvas to the Art Gallery of Ontario for a show he also helped curate. Days later, he received a call saying that the gallery's head curator had ordered the painting removed. It was a fake. A soft-spoken and unassuming man, Hearn says his heart sank at the news. He felt personally violated and angry that Morisot was being exploited. He sued the gallery in 2012 and, together with his lawyers, spent the next several years investigating Voss and Lamont as the ringleaders of a wide-ranging scam. Between 2012 and 2015, Hearn practically became a part-time private investigator as he and his lawyers interviewed more than 200 people, primarily around Thunder Bay, including associates of Voss and Lamont, other buyers who thought they had been duped, and Morisot's close friends and family members. They learned that Lamont and Voss, white men both, claimed to know Morisot. Lamont's father had been friends with Morisot, and the artist had given him several original paintings. In a court filing, Voss said that he, too, had met Morisot at a friend's house in Thunder Bay in the 1980s, and that he began purchasing authentic paintings from friends who lived in or near reserves. Hearn's investigative team found that, for years, Lamont and his wife had helped oversee a group home for Indigenous youth. Dallas Thompson, the Anishinaabe man who knew a Morisot relative, said Lamont operated the home as a virtual factory for producing fake Morisot paintings. Under Lamont's direction, youths and other Indigenous people in Thunder Bay were paid, or forced at threat of violence, to create Morisot lookalikes by the hundreds. And Thompson, Voss, and Lamont put them up for sale on eBay or drove across Canada, selling them to auctioneers and dealers for resale. Thompson, who says he gathered the courage to speak against Lamont years after being assaulted by him, told me that he alone witnessed or participated in the creation of at least 400 Morisot fakes. At a hearing during his lawsuit against the gallery, which began in October 2017, Hearn supplied experts who testified that the painting he'd been sold was a fraud. Thompson testified as well. But the defense offered countervailing evidence, including a handwriting expert who testified that, in his opinion, the signature on the painting was almost certainly Morisot's, which caused doubt in the judge's eyes. The burden was on Hearn, as the plaintiff, to prove that the painting was a fake. And according to the judge, Hearn didn't have the proof. In his 2018 decision, the judge acknowledged that a fraud ring existed in Thunder Bay, but he said the ring's existence didn't prove that the individual painting Hearn purchased was a fake. It was merely contested. The judge granted that Hearn and his experts might be right, but said they might be wrong too, and truth is not always attainable in the layperson's sense. He concluded that a tie goes to the defendants. Stymied by the courts, Hearn continued to pursue his cause outside of them. He contacted an old friend, a filmmaker named Jamie Kastner, who did his own reporting and put the results in a 2019 documentary under the ironic title, There Are No Fakes. The film brought to a larger audience the bewildering saga of the Morisot hoaxes, the various lawsuits and allegations involving Voss and Lamont. There Are No Fakes was powerful, thorough, and persuasive, but it received a little notice outside the province of Ontario. Fortunately, one unlikely viewer knew all about Voss and Lamont, and he saw in the film's evidence a way to finally take them down. Jason Ryback, 48, has been a cop since 2000 and is only 6 years away from retirement. We met on an August morning in 2023. Ryback has a shaved head and neat facial hair and wore a blue suit, a pink shirt, and a tie. After stopping at a Tim Hortons drive-thru for a cup of tea and touring Thunder Bay's rough spots in his car, blasting rock music, we made our way to the provincial police station. Until 2019, Ryback knew little of Morisot. After all, he works murders, not paintings. In fact, it was a decades-old homicide that brought the Morisot fakes to his attention. A cold case from the mid-1980s, when a 17-year-old named Scott Dove was murdered in Thunder Bay. None other than Gary Lamont had been a prime target of the investigation, but police lacked evidence to charge him, and the case remained unsolved. Ryback stayed in touch with Dove's mother, however, and she suggested that he watch a documentary mentioned her son. Ryback watched There Are No Fakes in late 2019. Afterwards, he says, I started looking into it, hoping that this would lead us to solve the murder of Scott Dove, but never really went down that trail and went right into this fraud. The first phone call Ryback made was to Hearn, whose lawyers provided Ryback with information about Lamont and Voss. In the numerous court battles involving Hearn, McDermott, and other buyers, collectors, and gallery owners, Then extensive documents were available online, leaving Ryback a list of interview sources. With the Thunder Bay Police Service understaffed and focused on safeguarding an infamously troubled city, Ryback called in the provincial police for additional resources. He also contacted the FBI's art crime team to help local law enforcement learn how to structure the investigation and which experts to consult in distinguishing between authentic Morisots and lookalikes. Instead of investigating the sellers of Morisots fakes, as the RCMP, that's the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, had done, Ryback focused on the foragers, beginning with people like Thompson. He also zeroed in on buyers who seemed to know who had been paid or approached to make fakes, where the art supplies were purchased and how the paintings were sold. To Ryback's surprise, he had little trouble loosening tongues. While some buyers were embarrassed that they had been hoodwinked, they generally weren't cagey, unlike most of his interviewees in homicide investigations. It was weird because everyone we dealt with liked us and was forthcoming, Ryback says. And some of them openly pointed to Lamont and Voss as the main culprits behind the scheme. More challenging was determining whether auctioneers, gallery owners, buyers, and even the painters for hire themselves had participated knowingly in the scam or simply been paid to paint without knowing the works were being advertised as Morisot's originals. Complicating matters, Ryback says, was that the courts had mistakenly ruled that certain fakes were authentic, which collectors, gallery owners, and sellers sometimes pointed to in legitimizing their fakes. Eventually, Ryback figured the best way forward was to reconstruct Morisot's nomadic life, like a biographer, interviewing anyone the painter had encountered. He learned that Morisot couldn't have pumped out the prints in the 1970s and 1980s, that certain galleries and owners were claiming, because during those years he wasn't working much, or when he was painting in a different style. The cops became de facto art critics and historians, able to discern between Morisot's distinct techniques during different periods in his life. Soon they were able to spot fakes from the real thing. They're noticeably different, except for a few, Ryback says. Some paintings were listed as having been painted by him after 2007. Morisot didn't paint a lot when he was dead, Ryback says. Ryback determined that Voss hatched the plan around 1996, forging paintings and selling and consigning them before amassing a team to produce fakes across Ontario and Alberta. When Ryback interviewed Voss's ex-wife, he recalls, she said she'd been waiting for 25 years for police to arrive at her door. Ryback concluded that by 2002, Lamont, who Ryback says may have been comrades with Voss in the drug underworld, borrowed the idea for himself and started a second ring doing the same thing. Lamont had photos of himself with Morisot on his website, which may have calmed the nerves of prospective buyers. Lamont sold the paintings online to people all over the world, which significantly expanded the operation. Another acquaintance of Lamont and Voss, who remains unnamed by the police, because he died before he could be criminally charged, had passed information about the scam to people in southern Ontario, which led to a third fraud ring that appeared around 2008, generating yet more fake art. For years, Ryback says, these three overlapping rings manufactured perhaps tens of thousands of fakes and spread them around the globe, generating tens of millions of dollars for themselves, auctioneers, and gallery owners. Ryback established that there was an entire Morisot industry, one that earned into the nine figures, and Norval Morisot never profited a nickel from it. Tracking down every forgery was impossible. There were simply too many already out there. In late 2019, Thunder Bay police raided 100 works from Lamont's Thunder Bay house, then found another stash in Voss's home nearby. In 2022, Ryback led a haul in Calgary that netted yet another 300, enough that a 24-foot van wasn't big enough to carry them all, and he had to locate a larger truck. At each location, Ryback and his colleagues discovered assembly lines of people had been producing Morisot lookalikes. Ryback found that the top arts institutions had fallen for the scam. In court, collectors pointed to these institutions as proof that disputed Morisots were indeed authentic. According to Ryback, the Canadian Senate building had a fake, and he believes that at least one of the 23 Morisot paintings and prints held by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian is a fake. There is no one straightforward way to go about answering a question about authentication, Gwen Manthey, a conservator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, told me. Manthey herself is one of a half a dozen painting conservators at the institution, part of whose job includes researching and vetting newly accessioned objects. She explained that the Smithsonian asks its donors about the provenance of the works it receives, and the institution does not believe the donor of the Morisseau collection had reason to doubt their authenticity. None of the questioned Morisseaus are on display at Smithsonian Museum, since proving their actual provenance is extremely difficult. Rachel Shabika, supervisory registrar at the National Museum of the American Indian, said, "I would imagine that most large museums have collections of things that they're not 100% sure about, particularly as an institution that's as old as the Smithsonian. There has been no immediate plans to display the disputed painting before the Smithsonian got wind of these allegations in 2019. Ultimately, Ryback's investigation took 2.5 years and involved nearly 100 law enforcement officials, who interviewed more than 270 people. In March 2023, he and other officials in Thunder Bay announced that they had arrested 8 people at the center of the fraud rings. Among the culprits were Lamont and Voss. Police filed 40 charges, among them forgery, fraud, and possessing stolen property with the intent of selling it. In the backdrop at the press conference announcing the charges were 10 or more of the 1,000 forged Morisseaus police had seized thus far. The precise number of fakes manufactured over the years is unknown, but could be more than 10,000, Ryback says, with the criminal profits amounting up to $100 million. In December 2023, Lamont pled guilty to 1 count of forgery and 1 count of defrauding the public above $5,000, and he was sentenced to 5 years in prison. In response, one Indigenous leader said the forgeries had criminally exploited First Nations artists and threatened to delegitimize the culture further. At his sentencing hearing, Lamont said that he was very sorry and remorseful of what I've done and take full responsibility. Ryback expects the plea to be the first of many. Trials for Voss and other suspects are scheduled to begin this year and next. Voss has been averse to talking with reporters and couldn't be reached for comment. Hearn, the collector whose initiative helped investigators get to the bottom of the scam, believes that Morisseau's identity as part of a marginalized group was helpful to the crooks. The success of the fraud ring, he says, illustrates the perpetuation of the problem with the relationship between Indigenous people and colonizers. The fraudsters were betting on the lack of outrage when Morisseau's reputation was tarnished. Ryback agrees and adds that the scammers were aware that Morisseau never kept a resume of paintings. The forgers knew there was no way, in their view, that anybody would ever be able to figure out what he actually painted. Meanwhile, Ryback and Hearn say that prospective buyers regularly call or email asking for guidance on authenticating this or that painting, worried they may have sunk large sums of money on worthless imitations. Some buyers were bilked out of their life savings. For the fraudsters, of course, the scheme was nothing more than a way to make money. But the devastation to honest buyers, to Morisseau and his legacy, to Indigenous culture, and to Canadian art writ large is incalculable. Morisseau's works were not meaningless paintings, but precious, irreplaceable examples of the Anishinaabe experience in Canada and the world. As Thompson told me, every painting is supposed to be an insight into my culture. Next, we'll move on to an article in the prologue section by Richard Grant titled The Butterfly Whisperer. Akito Kawahara has spent his life devoted to Lepidoptera. Now he's correcting the record on where they first evolved. When Akito Kawahara was 8 years old, his father took him on a members-only tour of the insect collection at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. His father, the renowned conceptual artist Own Kawara, had introduced him to the butterfly collecting early, and Akito had already amassed about 500 of his own specimens. Seeing the enormous cabinets and extensive floor displays of butterflies and other insects on the museum's fifth floor, Akito was thrilled, but what really captured his attention was an unassuming chart posted on the door of a curator's office. It was a phylogeny of butterflies, an evolutionary family tree, and it contained many blank spaces. I was so surprised that scientists didn't know how everything about this, and it became my childhood dream to figure out where butterflies come from, how they evolved, and how they're related to each other, says Kawahara, now a 45-year-old entomologist at the University of Florida. this past May, working with nearly 90 co-authors from 6 continents. He published the results of a massive global study of butterfly evolution based on DNA samples from 2,300 butterfly species. Not only does it fill in the gaps on the phylogeny chart he saw as a child, but it also presents a completely new origin story for these charismatic insects. Most scientists thought they evolved in Australasia, but it seems most likely that the first butterflies appeared in North and Central America. The ancestor of butterflies was a nocturnal moth that became day-flying here 101.4 million years ago. For Kawahara, the 8-year-long study was intensely personal because it found it impossible to separate the science of butterfly evolution from memories of his father. I became interested in butterflies because of him. He was the one who inspired me to follow my passion and become a butterfly scientist. And he was with me that day at the museum that I saw a poorly resolved butterfly phylogeny, and I dreamed of completing it. When Kawahara was 4 years old, his parents noticed that he was scared of insects and would run away from them. To help him overcome this fear, his father started taking him for walks in the parks of suburban Tokyo, looking for insects, talking about insects and carrying a butterfly net. "I still remember the first butterfly I collected," says Kawahara, his eyes brightening at the memory. "It was near my grandmother's house. I remember the exact place where the butterfly landed. It was a snout butterfly. I had seen it in books, and now it landed right in front of me. I remember my hand shaking and my dad helping me catch the butterfly." Kawahara still has that specimen in his personal collection in Tokyo, which now numbers between 5,000 and 10,000, and also serves as a remembrance of his father. In his youth, the family divided its time between Tokyo and New York. Kawahara attended schools in both cities, and on weekends, his father would take him on butterfly collecting trips. On Kawahara also traveled extensively to create his art and sometimes brought his son along, plus their butterfly equipment. As a boy, Kawahara gathered specimens from Singapore, Hawaii, Alaska, California, and all over Japan. He chose Cornell University for his undergraduate studies because of its excellent entomology department. As a graduate student at the University of Maryland in 2006, Kawahara named a newly described Costa Rican moth species after his father, Belthica oni, and later took his dad into the mountains of Costa Rica to find examples of the species. Moths were the focus of Kawahara's early career. He remains fascinated by them and likes to point out that butterflies are basically just moths that fly by day. Approximately half of moths have hearing abilities, and he's particularly interested in groups that can hear bat sonar and make acoustic signals to jam the sonar and escape predation. In 2014, Kawahara partnered with 2 fellow entomologists, Naomi Pierce from Harvard and David Lohman from City College of New York, and soon secured a $2.5 million grant from the National Science Foundation to study butterfly evolution. His father died at age 81 a few months before they wrote the proposal, but he had already planted the seed of the project in Kawahara's mind. One of our last conversations was about insect evolution, and he said, "What about butterflies? How did they evolve? You were always wondering about this as a boy." For the next 5 years, Kawahara's life was taken over by travel and fieldwork. He went to the Marquesas Islands in French Polynesia, to Borneo, Japan, Malaysia, Vietnam, India, New Zealand, Canada, parts of Africa, and many different locations in South America. In the Amazon and the Andes, he and his assistants collected American moth butterflies, butterflies that have become nocturnal like their distant ancestors, and developed hearing organs that they can detect bat sonar. "You have to collect them at night with lights, like moths," he says. Other butterfly species live only at the top of the rainforest canopy, and they had to be lured down with bait. Rotting fish is one way, Kawahara says. Other people say rotting fruit. But regardless, the bait always smells horrible. It's absolutely repulsive. Combination of chicken poop and urine works the best, I think, but different butterfly people have their own recipes. Male butterflies are particularly attracted to other creatures' excretions. They use minerals to make pheromones or female-attracting chemicals. Wasn't even necessary to kill the butterflies they collected to extract the DNA. All the researchers needed was a tiny piece of one leg. The butterflies could then be released to live out the rest of their short lives, 2 to 4 weeks on average, although some species live between 6 months and a year. In addition to their work in the wild, the researchers were able to obtain DNA from butterfly specimens around the world. from the small number of fossilized butterflies that have been found, primarily in Colorado, and from Kawahara's personal collection. Then came the enormous task of analyzing the data. A team had four supercomputers running simultaneously in Bonn, Germany, the University of Florida, at the Smithsonian Natural History Museum in Washington, D.C., and at Brigham Young University in Utah. Processing more than 370 million individual DNA pieces, or nucleotides, through models of DNA evolution, the supercomputers calculated the best hypothesis or probability of the butterfly evolutionary tree. Then, based on dating and fossils, they estimated the age of every possible branch in the tree. The result is a beautiful, elaborate diagram that looks more like a wheel than a tree. Besides the breakthrough discoveries into where and when butterflies originated, it demonstrates that 36 tribes of butterflies need to be reclassified and supports Kawahara's 2019 hypothesis on how and why moths started flying in the day. Since the oldest intact fossilized butterfly was 55 million years old and bats evolved in the same era, many scientists had thought that the group of moths became day flying to escape bat predation. Now we know, thanks in large part to Kawahara's revelatory work, that butterflies originated over 100 million years ago, some 35 million years before bats. Kawahara thinks that it was the bees, not bats, that caused the advent of day flying moths. Many studies have suggested that bees, which emerged some 125 million years ago, may have triggered plants to evolve nectar and colorful flowers to attract these busy, efficient daytime pollinators. All these flowering plants were a food opportunity, and we think the first day-flying moths took advantage of it, Kawahara says. They adapted to see color, search for flowers, and drink nectar. So butterflies should thank bees, I guess, is the consensus. Using a technique called ancestral state reconstruction, which maps the likeliest ranges of butterfly species and caterpillar host plants back in time through the family tree, researchers concluded that the first butterfly caterpillars probably fed on just one group of plants, the legumes or American bean plants. Kawahara's next project is focused on building a more detailed picture of butterfly evolution by using a much larger and more comprehensive DNA sampling than the 2023 study. For example, he hopes to narrow down where in North America the first butterflies originated. Kawahara has secured part of a $4 million collaborative grant from the National Science Foundation to study moth and butterfly silk, with a view to engineer stronger synthetic byproducts based on silk. In the last few years, partly because he's been so busy with work, Kawahara has stopped adding to his personal collection, which contains so many memories of his father and his boyhood. Instead, he's been helping his 9-year-old daughter, Kaya Luna Kawahara, to build up her insect collection. She particularly likes beetles, caterpillars, and the Luna moths that inspired her middle name. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.